Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth and Movies. I'm Leila Latif.
I'm Hannah Strong.
And I'm Rogan Graham.
On the show this week, conflict abounds in Civil War, and we spoke to both Alex Garland and Kristen Dunst. Amy Winehouse's estate are doing their thing in Back to Black. And on Film Club, we honour the very best of Dunst in Melancholia. All coming up on Truth and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, Hannah, I feel like I need to give you congrats at first for the new issue. It is gorgeous.
Yeah, it's always so weird when these things come out because obviously we spend so much time like working on them and then we're like, oh, yeah, that did come out. but yeah, no, we're very excited. I saw Challenges again like last week and still as good the second time around. So yeah, very excited. Like, I say this every issue, but it is like something quite special, this one, and this it's so like jam-packed as well. Like, there's a ton of interviews, ton of features. It really feels like everyone kind of went above and beyond this time, both our side of things and then like Luca and Zendaya and everyone were so like generous. So yeah, it's big fun and it feels really like springy as well, like all the kind of, you know, the color and everything. It's very, yeah, it makes me smile looking at it, which is the joy of kind of the printed article, I guess.
I mean, one of my favorite kind of WhatsApp groups being lit on fire was the podcast one with that I'm in with the team for Little White Lies, just after we all got to see it, and just everybody going wild. It's such a good film. I think in particular, like, there was a lot of chat about, like, almost like in Jaws, when people are horny, there's a particular, like, ba-da-ba.
Yeah, music sting. Yeah. I mean, by the time that this episode comes out, I think the review embargo will have lifted on the film, because it's coming out this week, I think, the 12th is the embargo. So, yeah. So, by the time people are listening to this, so they'll be, like, hopefully understand what we see in the film. If they don't, it'd be awkward, But yeah, I know I'm excited for everyone to love it as much as we did, hopefully.
Maybe because also a little bit like it was delayed because of the actor strike. And so it didn't come out in Venice like we thought. But like, I remember sitting down at this and just being like, the movies are back. Like, it was quite a spiritual experience, to be honest. I loved it. Anyway, sorry. But future ep. Not something we need to get into now. Rogan, how are you doing?
I'm good. I've also seen Challenges and absolutely loved it. I had a week where I saw La Chimera and Challenges, and now I'm full Josh O'Connor pilled.
What a
love
man.
Love that guy. Love that guy. Not enough to watch The Crown, I don't think.
Oh, but yeah, no, I'm not doing that.
Not doing The Crown, but yeah, very, very well. I'm looking forward to, yeah, the next few weeks of movies. This week, I don't know so much, but the next few weeks for sure.
One of the films this week is great. We're just not going to say which of the three.
Yeah, not yet anyway, no.
Well, you are quite right to be aggrieved with The Crown, because, I mean, it didn't go into a piece that I was writing, but so I feel I can say that, like, Josh O'Connor, all he wanted when he was on The Crown, he told me in an interview, was a little paperweight, and they wouldn't give it to him. And then he asked them if it could be his, like, end of shoot gift, and they also said no.
What, like a prop paperweight? Like paperweight.
Yeah, they did basically like a paperweight that was like a commemorative Prince Charles paperweight, but with his face on it, and it's all he wanted, and they wouldn't give it to him.
What? That,
that's so mean. I'm sorry,
that is like tight as fuck.
So, that is I'm sorry. So tight.
Mm-hmm. We need to start a campaign, get Josh's paperweight, because like that's messed up.
He has such big hands, he could have stolen it. Well, stolen it and no one would have known.
If he had the suit from La Chimera, yeah. Stick it in the pocket.
Well, this is the delight of Josh O'Connor, where he was saying that like he couldn't bring himself to steal it. So he was just like, if I just look like I want it, maybe they'll give it to me as a present. And they didn't.
They would have known it was him though, if he'd been like, can I have this? And they said no. And he went this. I wonder who could have possibly stolen it. Bless him. Oh, what a sweetie.
Poor thing. But yeah, I mean, he is so good in challenges. All of the times where like I feel like I've been a bit of a, well, not a naysayer of his, but like, basically just not acknowledging him as being the greatest person who's ever lived, as seems to be the case with most film journalists. I'm converted. He's the greatest person he's ever lived.
I just have not, like, I've really liked him since God's Own Country. And every time I speak to someone who has worked with him or met him, they're like, oh my God, he's just like such a pure soul. And like, that I think is quite rare. Like we hear about people being like, yeah, they're nice, but like, everyone only has kind of the sweetest things to say about him, which is nice. You know, I just like knowing that, like we had Dev Patel on last week, we've got Kirsten Dunst on today, and it's like, it's just nice knowing that these people are like down to earth, you know, like it makes me happy.
Regan, anyone that you want to say that maybe on the counter side you've heard is horrible?
let's
cough,
not
J-Lo, cough.
I'm just going to save that for the memoirs, I think.
Well, yeah, you know, that's nice, though. In these troubled times, we can all come around through the shared love of Josh O'Connor.
I think in sort of, with challenges, it's good because, like, the character he's playing is, like, the worst.
And really reminded me of someone I knew, which was, like, I had a real kind of, oh, I need to talk that through with someone. But he was great. Josh was great.
Josh O'Connor chat over.
Let's get on to Civil War.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. We receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies.
In the near future, a team of journalists travel across the United States during a rapidly escalating multi-party second American Civil War that has engulfed the entire nation. But before we start, here is Hannah speaking to Kirsten Dunst and yours truly tearing up with Alex Garland.
Okay, straight into it. So Lee obviously feels like a very different character for you to play, which I was really enjoyed seeing. It's nice when they're seeing an actress I really like get to do something different, flex a different muscle. So what did you kind of respond to when you first read Alex Garland's script?
I was like very, reading that movie, it was very tense. You know, I was pretty blown away because I had never read anything like this before. And often when you're reading a script, you really look at your character, but this I just read. You know, it didn't take me out. I was with the film reading it. He's such an amazing writer. So yeah, I've been a fan of Alex's for a long time. So, and he makes so few films. So I was very, very excited. I knew he was meeting with someone else as well. So I like really didn't want to get my hopes too high, but he's one of those directors that I really wanted to work with.
It's probably at your level. You're still like, oh, I can't get too excited.
Well, yeah, he was meeting with someone else too.
Did you know who it was? You don't have to say.
I'm not going to say, but yes, I do. But very different. Yeah, like... Very different. I think so. Yeah.
With Lee, what kind of informed your depiction? Obviously, in the film, they talk about, her name has gone out of my head.
Lee Miller.
Lee Miller, yeah. Thank you. But yeah, for you, what kind of references, I guess, what kind of starting point did you have in your head?
For me, my reference was Maria Colvin, because, I mean, she wasn't a photojournalist, but Under the Wire was the most moving for me, of the documentaries or books that I took a look at, that was the thing that I wanted Lee to possess the most, which isn't look at me at all. And then I also was impressed by the script because it was nothing said female war journalist. She's, you know, being saved by this or there was zero of that. It's a man's role in a normal movie. That's also why I was so excited and wanted to play this.
Yeah, weirdly, when I came out of the film, a friend said, oh, it's a very kind of masculine role. And I was like, oh, actually, yeah, I get what you mean. It could have been in kind of other films I've seen about war journalism.
Yeah.
It is the guy who goes in, and the woman is kind of in like, oh, you know, like we should hold back, whatever. And I mean, you know, it's kind of refreshing to see a film that doesn't telegraph its kind of credentials, I think.
Exactly. Well. Yeah, you're so right. Very well said. It is. I was like, I'm going to use that. Thanks, Anna.
No, you're welcome.
Clock that one. Wait, what'd you say again? Telegraph
their credentials.
Their credentials. I like that phrase. That's a good one.
Yeah, I mean, I watch a lot of movies and, you know, sometimes it is very much just like, yes, queen. And it's like, we don't need to do that all the time. Sometimes, yeah, but like, you know, I think with a war movie as well, it's like, you know, it's the last thing these people are thinking about.
Yeah, exactly. And I didn't want my acting to be that way either. Like, I'm the lead, so I'm gonna act real hard.
Yeah,
it's more powerful to not be that way, in my opinion.
Exactly. And the film is so much about like trauma and the kind of being in these situations.
Yes.
A friend of mine who actually hosts the podcast was in Sudan kind of during the civil war that was kicking off or getting worse a few months ago, and she said it was incredibly accurate to her experience of leaving a country during the war.
Oh, she saw the movie with you?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
So she spoke to Alex yesterday. This is going to be great for the podcast. This is going to be like, what's going on here? But that was something that I really responded to, is the fact that the film is very much about the headspace of kind of going into these environments. It's not just these things happening and everyone deals with it. Fine.
Because yeah, you wouldn't deal with that. No.
Then, you know, obviously the way we see Lee kind of unravel throughout the film, you know, the kind of toll it takes on her mentally reflects, I think, the experience of watching the film. You know, we're kind of in that headspace with her.
Yeah.
How do you prepare for a role that you know is going to be quite like emotionally demanding?
I don't think about it as emotionally demanding. And I don't think about movies as having fun or it needs to be this or that. It's just a day-to-day thing like anything in life. And I prepare as best as I can. I do a lot of psychology with myself and the character. And I do a lot of dream work where I write myself kind of things I want to find out about Lee before bed so that my unconscious mind tells me instead of anything analytical.
I read this in the Mary Claire profile you did, and I was so fascinated by it because I'd never come across that before.
My lady, yeah. She's so cool.
It's such a, I mean, I feel like that could work in general life as well.
It does.
You want to solve,
yeah, but it's like, should I take this job or that job? I mean, sometimes it's hard for me to interpret my own dreams, but she's very good at interpreting the core of things. Sometimes I can more than others, but yeah. And the more you do it, the more dreams you get. So even when you're working, you'll get dreams and you'll be like, ooh, or think of something during a scene that you can use from a dream, or act out your dreams privately, like in a room with no one in it, obviously, like, and figure out the emotions through this.
Everyone could benefit from this.
Well, she works. I'm the only one who blows up her spot. I was like, Greta, she's the best. She's the best. I think other people don't want you to know that they do, that they have someone that helps them.
You know, that's true. I remember I was doing an interview at Christmas with an actor, and they said, like, a lot of times, you know, they're very open about like working with acting coaches.
Yeah, yeah.
And like, you know, the fact it kind of takes a village, you know, no one's like.
Everything takes a village.
Exactly.
Children, life, friendship. I mean, so it's all like, but yeah, Greta Seacat is an incredible acting teacher.
What kind of came to you from that process with Greta for this film? Do you remember anything specific?
You know what? I don't, for some reason. I really don't. Maybe it was like nightmares, and that's why I don't remember it. I've blocked it out. I don't imagine
it would have been pretty intense.
Yeah, I really don't remember. I would tell you, but I really don't. I do remember, though, one, which was a really fun gift, I thought, for myself. I dreamt, it was a long dream, there were other things in it, but I did in my dream see a tape that said Scooby-Doo, you know, like a VHS tape that said Scooby-Doo in my dream. And Greta and I were talking, she's like, because she makes you close your eyes, she's like, what is Scooby-Doo, what does it make you think of? And I was like, how they walk and how they scurry and run. And she's like, there's Peggy's walk in Fargo.
I see it now.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
So like, wow. But that was like a primo gift. I was like, yeah, thank you, Inner Self.
I've been thinking about Scooby-Doo.
I don't tell anybody because that would sound stupid to them, maybe. You know, you don't want to be rejected for your own inside things that are private.
Yeah.
Like Kaylee and I, for instance, I shared something that Greta and I talked about. This is something that is not from a dream, but I was like, Kaylee, what if, you know, in our scene in the lobby, I was like, what if, and I was like, I don't want to sound corny, but what if I'm your long lost mother and you're my long lost daughter? And we just leave it at that. And then when we do the scene, we're talking about Kevlar and all this stuff, but underneath there's a tether already, a soul connection immediately. So those are the kind of things I do too.
Yeah. So it's stuff that like you guys have in your head, but it's not kind of,
yeah,
to the audience, it's not necessarily, there's something.
But you feel it, yeah, but you don't know what it is.
Because obviously like, in that opening scene.
But she was open to that shit. Because I did it. I don't want to like direct her. I wasn't trying to direct her. I was just like, what if it's this? Because then,
we have a little thread to kind of keep in the back of our minds.
Well, so just for that scene, just little things, little cues to keep things alive, because usually other things are going on underneath rather than just like, you should wear Kevlar and get a helmet, girl. You know what I mean? It's like,
I think from the second they have that exchange, it's like, oh, okay. Like,
there's something. Well, that's why.
Exactly. I mean, this is fascinating for someone who does struggle a lot with like decision making in her own life. Uh-huh. So I'm going to be like, hey, like before we go to bed, let's start thinking about this. Speaking of Jesse, one of my favorite actors. You two are a like power couple to me.
So funny. We need a production company. We need to use this power.
You really do.
All our power goes to these two boys right now.
I mean, that's the best thing it could possibly go to. Mm-hmm. But I know that he kind of came on Civil War after someone else dropped out. Did he raise an eyebrow when you said, hey, there's this like racist psychopath character I think you'd be perfect for? Like,
I don't think he would have been in the movie if I wasn't. He kind of did us a favor.
Yeah, he's just around. You're like, oh, yeah, just get him in. Like,
yeah, I was available. Like, Alex was like, I'm going to talk to Jesse. I was like, you should. Jesse should do this. He's the best actor.
It's a weird thing to say, but he really plays that role well. And it's
he does.
It's terrifying.
It's terrifying. The scene is terrifying.
The way it
was written is terrifying.
So, I mean, for the writing, because obviously, like, some screenplays, it comes alive in the acting, but you're saying that like, you
it's
read this.
In there. It was terrifying in the script.
Oh, gosh.
And his casualness is what's making it terrifying. The way he holds the gun, the way he just shoots somebody without even a thought. It's his casualness that made it terrifying to me.
You know, I feel like that's kind of one of the big strengths of the film is that like we're seeing seeds of the things in the film, like in kind of society in the UK now, but also in America.
Way worse, even.
Yeah,
way
worse. And you're right, it's that like, kind of, I know, the casualness, the normalization of it, where just people don't think about the violence and become
and
so...
And the humanity between, that we're all, yeah, the that's humanity the
that's
lost.
Yeah, that was so kind of confronting about the film.
Yeah,
that,
I thought so too.
You know.
I even felt that way, and I was in the movie.
And that tends to kind of demystify, you know, a little when you're kind of there, being like, do it again. But if you're feeling it as an actor, it's kind of...
I felt it watching the movie. I was like, whoa, I've never seen anything like this before. And I was like, yeah, I haven't really seen an anti-war movie like this. I just haven't seen anything like it.
We think of, I think, war movies as, you know, generally when you watch them, they're incredibly, like, cinematic. And this is cinematic, but in a kind of different way. It feels very raw.
Documentaries, yeah. Feels way more, raw. You're right.
Exactly, yeah. And you're in it so deeply with the characters. Mm-hmm. What was the kind of most challenging aspect? Because obviously, you've done kind of superhero movies before, but, like, being something where you're all kind of moving around, there's explosions going off, there's, like, gunfire and shouting.
Yeah.
What was kind of the most difficult thing for you to kind of, I mean, you're a professional, I'm sure it wasn't.
No, it was very, 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 very loud. Like, because Alex wants things to feel immersive, instead of using half rounds or quarter rounds in our blanks, we used full rounds.
Oh my gosh.
So that just gives you, if we were here in this room all day with that gunfire sound, it's intense.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what it's like to be in a real war, but Alex wanted it to feel as authentic as possible. Like, even at the end, how there's these big pauses in between gunfire, there's that silence. I've never not really seen that kind of thing in a movie. It feels, I mean, we had real ex-military in the film, stuntmen, choreography. I mean, they choreographed all these sequences into such detail. And then as journalists, you know, we're following them, getting out of their way. And Lee obviously knows all the signals of when to go and what's when it's safe. And
learn the challenges of kind of working on this farm. I mean, all the signals and things. You have to kind of learn all that kind of choreography of it as well.
But that was, I guess, what it was the biggest. I don't really have like the biggest challenge in playing Lee because I felt very much in service of this movie playing Lee. I didn't feel like, you know, how I felt.
It's all part of the character.
This
isn't the first film where you have played a role in taking down a president either.
Dick.
I'm glad you got there before I did.
Never thought that.
One of my like favorite films of yours. I think it's so funny and it was so ahead of its time and like I like the idea of like teenager girls watching that film now and being like, oh my god, this is great.
Yeah.
Did you think about this tour when you were on the White House again? And it's 25 this year. So
wait, what'd you say?
It's 25 years old this year.
Oh so, yeah.
Sorry.
Hey, thanks. You old, Kirsten. You might not feel like it, but you are.
I mean, that made me feel very
How old are
well.
You?
I'm 31.
Okay.
And then, you know, for me now, journalists are coming up who, like, were born when I was in high school, and I'm like, no, you're so young.
I know.
When I go and give lectures to school, I'm like, no, don't do it. that film, what are your kind of memories of shooting that with Michelle? I imagine that must have been a very different vibe to shooting Civil War.
Oh, yeah. Michelle and I had the best time together. We chemistry read, though, for that movie, her and I. I was cast, and then we were looking for a counterpart, and we just immediately had a sparkle together. So we just, like, had a very silly time. I think I love doing comedy, so I just love the idea of playing a ditzy teenager taking down the White House. Yeah, it was great.
We need to get you in another comedy, I think. Like, it's...
I agree. I would love that.
Because even like on Being a God in Central Florida, it's like, it's funny, but it's like...
No, that's...
Also very serious.
Yes, and you're right.
You know, kind of... Things happened there as well with how it ended. But I mean, I would love to see that.
I would like to be in one.
Alex said, you know, because you've been making films such a long time, he felt like he was kind of learning from you.
And that
you
was very sweet of him.
Have you ever been tempted to kind of like look at directing or writing, that kind of thing?
I opened Final Draft once and I like wrote one line and like, an hour and I just sat there thinking of how best to describe the scene and like I tried. You know what? Taking a shower alone is about what I can handle right now. That's what is my life. Like with two young boys, like if I can shower alone, that is a feat. So yeah. I don't think I'm in the headspace to direct right now.
But one day maybe.
When I'm older. Way older.
It's good for us all to have something, you know.
Like, to look
I
forward
keep saying
to.
That as well. When yeah. you know, when my cat's grown up, I'll be look at it.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank
that
you.
Was delightful. Hi, Alex. How are you?
Good. Thank you. Hi.
I feel I need to give you a little bit of context at the beginning of this to make it fair. So I'm a journalist. I was actually in a civil war, and I had to document it. So this was very. Very much for me, I suppose. I loved it. I think it really captured what that's like, I suppose.
That's interesting. Disturbing, difficult to watch as well. I'd hate to have turned it into entertainment. You know, that would have been awful.
No, I think what I really found so incredible about it was like, I think when you're caught up in a situation like that, you know, when it's crossfire, the idea of goodies and baddies goes out of the window, doesn't it? Even though... So I think actually, I think it captured something really profound.
I also think many people, when particularly in an American context, they think of American Civil War, which was very delineated over the issue it was fighting over and the sides that were fighting. And in some ways, that can be quite atypical, that many civil wars are really just disintegrations, sort of factionalized disintegrations, and in which case that sense of what side is fighting for what gets even more blurred, I think.
Do you feel like that has been kind of an unfair assumption that's been put on the film, though, because you're going with this title of Civil War and that's the kind of reference that people go to, that they're sort of assuming it's going to be a commentary on the American Civil War?
No, in a way, it could almost be a plus. It's not unfair. I think it's just the way it is. And that is to say, for many people, that will be their association. But you could be of a certain age and from Yugoslavia or Syria or wherever it is, and have a completely different association. I think it's more just, I can see, and this is true of everything you put in a story, I can see why it would create inferences, but the inference would in a way belong to the individual maybe more than the narrative itself, their own lived experience.
I mean, I suppose so much many people experience of sci-fi, but like their formative ones are things like Star Trek or Twilight Zone, where you're sort of so specifically referring to something of the era.
Yeah.
You kind of want to get away from like making a kind of one-to-one comparison.
A one-to-one comparison with?
Like current events and sort of heightening them through science fiction.
I think there is elements of one-to-one comparison, but it just depends what you select as a viewer. What one selects is something to notice or not notice. So there's two separate things. There's the intention of the film, and there's the structure of the film, and there's the scenes or discussions within the film. And then there is really another 50%, which is contained by the viewer. And there is a deliberate space left there. You can construct a movie which is attempting to pose questions and answer them, which could be to do with a character's motivation or anything, really, as explicitly as possible. The interesting thing for me is that it doesn't matter how explicit you are, people will still insert their own subjective take, which would mean two friends sitting side by side would disagree about what Iron Man was doing at this particular moment or something, or, you know, whatever it might be. But I think this film probably leans hard towards that because it has an agenda, really.
Oh, you feel like it is a film with an agenda?
Yeah.
Interesting. I mean, because you were writing it, I suppose, what would have been like 2021 and then shooting and then now it coming out. Is that?
I think 2020. I could be getting the dates wrong. It was just after COVID outbreak, really just after. I got sick quite quick, sort of first in the first wave of people who got sick, and took me weeks and weeks to come out of that. When I came out of it, it was a very different world and everything. It sounds sort of strange to put it like this now, but in some ways, everything was very quiet, oddly, and gave me a lot of time to reflect, I suppose. And I wrote it at that point. So it's pretty much bang on 4 years ago, just shy of 4 years ago.
And like, have there been things that have kind of happened in the years since that you think have kind of, you know, reinvigorated it in terms of, I don't know, relevancy to the current nightmare?
No, I'm not sure I would put it like that, because that would, what I'd say is that the circumstances that existed 4 years ago still exist, and it's not like they disappeared and then came back. It's more they have been continually compounded, is probably how I would see it. I think that I'm not sure this is what you're saying, actually, but maybe in some tangential way this applies. I think if you write something that has a quality of the here and now about it, it can look prescient because everybody understands that films take a while to make. So it is as if it had foresight. But I think if you cast your mind back to 4 years ago, or indeed 6 years ago or further, the anxieties that lie behind this film and the agenda that would exist within the film, all not only applied, was commonly talked about, discussed, felt amongst individuals in the media. So that obliquely goes back to your question, because in a way, I think I'm saying nothing's gone away. Nothing's been reinvigorated. It's been there for quite a long time. Now, what it is, that one could debate that, I suppose. But I can't think of an anxiety expressed within this film that you could not have also expressed, say, 4 years ago, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, no, I understand. Having your sort of, central character, having this, you know, documenting something, having journalists, you know, did you kind of feel parallels with like what you were trying to do, and that you were sort of trying to reflect upon the world around you, and that's, and they're kind of, you know, in a similar way, trying to like capture the horrors of existence?
There's a sort of game happening to do with the journalism. I think one is a deliberate throwback to a particular kind of journalism, which is about reporting. I saw this is what happened. and keeping personal bias out of it. And also the way journalism has come under attack and where it's come under attack from, and also things journalism has done to itself to an extent as well. I think then the film is trying to do something like that older form of journalism. So it is, and I say this partly because I grew up around journalists. My dad was a cartoonist. He worked on a newspaper, and I literally grew up around journalists, around the dinner table and sort of chatting, and my godfather and my brother's godfather, both foreign correspondents. So some of these sort of questions about where your voice is allowed or not allowed to exist within within a piece of reporting was a conversation I was really familiar with. And the film is partly celebrating journalists, also showing some of the tensions they have or conflicts inside themselves, I suppose. It is throwing back to that period. So just separating myself from the politics right now, I think one could reasonably say that CNN and Fox News are a kind of advertising-led news outlet that is aiming itself at a constituency in order for viewing figures, which increase their revenue. And that there's something happening there that creates bias and stops people trusting news, in effect. But I think it's a much more, that would be one very small part of an overall picture, but it's just to be illustrative of that thing. So the film is then attempting to be like an old-fashioned piece of journalism in some respects. So it is just showing you something and keeping I'm trying to find a way to say this where I'm not irritating myself, but it's something like, it's something to do with voice. It's something to do with subduing the sort of omniscient narcissism of one's own voice and just trying to present something. So it's something like that.
Oh, well, thank you very much. That's beautifully put. And thank you for, I love the film, and it was very profound and actually cathartic experience for me. So yes, I hope you have wonderful rest of the press tour.
I appreciate that. And I think what I want to say is I'm grateful and I'm pleased that if you have encountered some of these things and felt that the film was fair in some of its depictions, then not just me, but many of the people who worked on the film will find that a relief, but also gratifying. So thank you.
Thank you. That's lovely. So, Rogan, I mean, I think people that have like heard me basically like sobbing over a Zoom with Garland would know that like this is a film that meant a lot to me. Bit of a weird one because obviously it reflects something that like happened to me almost a year ago. But for those who weren't in civil wars of late, Rogan, yes. What did you make of it?
Me? I mean, I don't have super strong feelings about Alex Garland as a director. So I went into the film like, sure, you know, I'll watch it. Or, you know, that's fine. And I came out a nervous wreck. I mean, we saw it in IMAX, which was quite funny. Alex introduced the film and he said, I didn't know they could blow it up this big, which was quite funny. But it was an incredibly stressful watch, but in good and bad ways. I mean, I have quite, I think, complicated feelings about this film because I think it really works on a cinematic level. I think you can go in and have a really incredible movie experience, but I feel so conflicted about the kind of like apoliticalness of it. And you might disagree with me on that, but it's a film about, I mean, as you would have heard in the interviews, about war journalists, war photographers. And there's almost this sort of neutral stance in the film that the film takes, similar to the journalists. They're just simply there to document. And I found that quite frustrating because the story kind of hinges on, you know, if Trump's insurrection succeeded, and then doesn't engage any further with the implications of that and what that means. So as much as I had really strong feelings watching it. I mean, the sound is insane. Like, I think if you do watch this, kind of be prepared for like the full adrenaline of it, of Civil War. But yeah, I don't know. It's you kind of think about it too long and pull on a thread, and the film kind of unravels a little bit for me. I'm not sure, Hannah, if you felt the same way or similarly.
Yeah, I think we had a kind of a brief chat after the film, which was interesting because I think we were all kind of aligned, like you, me, my friend Laura, and your friend Ruth. Like, we were all kind of like, we have some issues, but we did all share that kind of moment of being like, because we were sat next to each other as well, we kind of like, you know, we could see each other being like, this is a very stressful film to watch. And I've seen a lot of stressful films before, like Uncut Gems is an incredibly stressful experience, like, but this was... You did, and I totally understand, like Layla kind of saying that it was, you found it very close to something that you'd actually been through in Sudan, because that is how it feels. It is like an assault, and it doesn't really let up. You kind of are in it from the start until the end. There's a few moments that are quieter, but that doesn't make them any, in fact, some of them are more chilling because of what is kind of going on and, you know, the sort of people that emerge. But yeah, I mean, the kind of, it's not only that the film itself is apolitical, it's like all of Alex Garland's statements around it have kind of hindered its cause further by him being like, oh well, you know, I think we just have to look at it from two sides, and it's like, I think one of those sides might be full of literal Nazis, and you know, the other side has like bad actors, but you know, not quite the same level. So you know, it feels like in refusing to be specific, it kind of loses a bit of like its potency, which, you know, isn't to take anything away from the cast, who I think are all like really, really quite exceptional in the film. And I'm sure we'll talk about them in a second. But yeah, I don't know. I could not detach the politics of the film from the film, which is like something that I think he's kind of asking us to do. And there's so many kind of little moments in it where you're like, oh, he's being like, look, these guys have like nail polish and dyed hair, but they're using ableist slurs. And it's like, oh, okay. Like, you know, there's just kind of these weird moments that like he's clearly making a point with like a capital P, and it just felt a bit like, yeah, we can tell you're like an elder Gen Xer.
Yeah, and British.
And British. Too. And
like,
British.
Truthfully, like it's... You know, I think it's a very interesting film about war journalism and war photography. And I think, Hannah, it was you who said this, but really not a good film about America or American politics. I mean, there's this kind of showdown at the end. Basically, the plot of the film is this group of war journalists trying to get to the president because they want to speak to him. He doesn't speak to press, and like that is their mission. So there's this kind of showdown at the end, and there is a black woman on one side and another black woman on the other side. And I suppose the idea is, you know, there are all these kind of quote unquote progressive slogans like believe black women, trust black, you know, all this, especially in America and American culture and politics, is like black women as like the moral compass. And that's a whole bizarre thing to get into. And then Alex Garland is clearly making a point by having black women on either side, being like, well, you know, which black woman? Neither black woman is right. A woman is right. And it's like, well, what do you mean by that? He's not really making a decision. And it's just incredibly frustrating. I think if this is a film that wasn't so grounded, at least superficially, in things that have happened or could happen, I'd have a lot less issues with it, a lot fewer issues with it. And there is this weird, I mean, I've said that there's this like racial blindness, but then there's a lot of death in the film. It's, you know, about a war, but the way certain deaths are depicted and the way the camera lingers on certain characters as opposed to others is, it's hard to tell whether that is part of his commentary or whether that is a complete blind spot for him. The deaths of like black characters, or not even characters, black people within the film, are so much more brutal and so much more drawn out than the white characters.
I don't even think he's been asked about that. I've not heard him be asked about that, because I think you mentioned that like straight after we came out, and we were all like, oh, like I noticed that as well. It did feel quite glaring. And I remember, you know, Brandon Cronenberg's Possessor, which I know you're a fan of, Layla, is the same as me, and I think it's a great film, but there's a very, very violent scene in that film against a black woman. And I remember my friend commenting on it and being like, she hated the film because of that one scene. She was like, I think it's a really disgusting moment in the film. And he is completely unaware of like the kind of racial optics of that scene. And I wonder if it is the same thing with Alex Garland. It's just like totally does not occur to these like, you know, male filmmakers, white male filmmakers, that putting that kind of thing on screen without, you know, kind of intention or without expressing that intention in a kind of, I don't know, a well-executed way is I think like quite irresponsible and also like very traumatizing within, even within the context of a war film. Like, I don't know. I just came out with like so many questions and not the questions I kind of expected to have. But I mean, I will say, like, I kind of mentioned it already, but I do think like the cast are really amazing. Like, Kirsten's had like a lot of kind of rave reviews already, but I think she's fantastic. I wasn't very familiar with Wagner Moura, but like he's great. I've come out like a full like stan. I think he's so good at playing this kind of like almost like a tragic foil character where he's like very wisecracking and like very kind of, you know, sarcastic, but clearly like a hair's breadth away from like losing his mind.
I truly believe that the world is divided into Wagner Moura fans and people that haven't seen Wagner Moura act. Like, to know him is to love him. He's incredible.
He really is.
Was he in Devs as well? Or...
He was in Narcos. I actually first came to him with The Shining Girls, and I was texting friend of the pod, Hafez Salas Ross, where I was just like, you know, there's this Brazilian actor in this show that I really like. And, you know, it turns out he's a superstar in Brazil. And then, he had a very small part in The Gray Man. Probably the best bit of The Gray Man. But
okay, that's where I've seen him. Okay, yeah.
That's a shame that's your your touching point.
He has a really great episode in the new Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Donald Glover show, where it's him and, oh my gosh, Parker Posey are the other Mr. and Mrs. Smith. But he's really great in that, very funny. He's just like pure charisma, but also... for Civil War, big shout out to Stephen McKinley Henderson.
Of course, he was just pumping, but like, yes.
Yeah.
Who was cut out of Dune Part 2. We were robbed.
And then we got this. God. And he's so good in this.
Like, he's so good in this. Stephen McKinley Henderson, he's just wonderful. And it's such a good ensemble. Like, they work so incredibly well. And it's as stressful as we've like really emphasized, this film is as a watch. I just feel my cortisol climbing. He's really grounded in really incredible performances. And I think that, you know, it's like tepid and like disappointing the politics are of the film. And you know, I wasn't expecting a full on, you know, Nick Offerman to do a full Trump impersonation and like come out orange with yellow hair. Like that's not what I was after either. But if you're talking about like the aftermath of, you know, a president like that succeeding in his coup, then you should have some thoughts. But yeah, it's still, you watch it and you get something from it, I think. And it's been a while, I think, since I've seen a film that I, you know, have been pretty lukewarm on, really, but still think it was a really good movie going experience.
I don't know if I could just kind of like do my full spiel, but yeah, having like had to document Civil War coming out of Sudan, like almost like coming up to a year ago, it just felt so honest politically in a weird way. Like, so one of the things that happened to us is, like, you know, in Sudan we've got the Sudanese army and we've got the RSF, which is basically a genocidal militia, who are battling things, and like very much on one side. I mean, army sucks, but like would far prefer them to be in charge as opposed to like the genocidal maniacs. And when we were coming out, one of the things that happened is like we got boarded like many times on this like long bus, this long journey that took a few days, like going across the country, and we got stopped by both sides.
And I cannot tell you how much it doesn't matter what side people are on. Like, we had the most horrendous, vicious people that were like threatening to shoot people who, because they had like a tattoo they didn't approve of, from the side that we were on. And we had some like really sweet guys coming on and being just like almost like sharks. Oh, sorry, I got to do this. Like really like sweet guys. And you're just like, oh, you know, I'd hang out with you in under different circumstances, who were on the side that we oppose. So it's like actually weirdly to me, in terms of the politics, this was like incredibly refreshing.
Yeah, I mean, I think you might have even said this to me, but I think you said, like, when you have a gun pointed at you, like, it doesn't really matter, like, what the poll. You're not thinking, I wonder how they feel about abortion rights. Like, so, I do think, like, that, and having your perspective on it, like, was incredibly valuable for me. At the time of recording this, I haven't listened to your interview with Alex, which I am looking forward to listening to, because I do think, like, that gave me, like, an additional appreciation. And I think, like, it's definitely not. I remember being very skeptical when I heard about it. When I saw the trailer, I was like, I don't know about this, man. And it's definitely, I think, a film that I would kind of not necessarily happily watch again, but I would be interested in watching it again, because I do think it has interesting things to say. And I love seeing Jesse Plemons be a complete psychopath, which he gets to do very well in this film. I do kind of worry about the fact that Kirsten Dunst said to Alex Garland, oh, you know who could play that role? My husband. but you know, I definitely think it's a really cinematic, sounds like, you know, it sounds like a weird thing to say about a war film, but it is, like, it's an experience. And I'm a little sad that he says he's not going to make more films, because I think when he's good, he's really good. And I say this as someone who really, like, vehemently hated men.
But oh my god, I hated men.
Something like this.
Sorry, I love you, Alex, but I hated men.
Yeah. It's just bad. But like, yeah, this isn't an Annihilation. Like, you know, I think he has some interesting ideas. And, you know, more work for Stephen McKinley. It's something I think all of us want to see. So
for sure. I mean, I agree. Like, I would watch it again. I'd read, you know, it's interesting. I'd read around it. And Layla, your perspective is really helpful. And it's true that, yeah, it doesn't matter who's pointing the gun at you when a gun is pointed at you. But just, I think another thing that, and this is something that jarred me when the film first started. And then I eased into it. But, you know, they're taking film photographs, like developing film during this war. And I think being on social media, you know, the past 6 months and seeing the journalists in Gaza documenting on their iPhones and taking care of animals and taking care of young orphan children, and then this kind of, you know, this very American, we are only there to observe and like do our work the best we can, that kind of detachment just was icky to me. And again, that could very well be the point of the film, but I also don't know the point of the film, because I don't know, because I don't understand Alex Garland's perspective. But that is one thing that did just kind of jar me. But then I, you know, I've said it's not the best film about America, and maybe that is what it's saying about America. I don't know, but it's an interesting film to talk about, and if I get a chance, I might go and see it again after I read around it a bit.
I feel like we could talk about it for the whole episode, because I think we all have like so much to say on it. Like, it, even just you mentioning then about the iPhones, I remember we were like, oh yeah, why are they not shooting on their phones? That's so weird, because they've all got their phones, and they say like, oh, there's no broadcast towers anymore, but like they still need the phones to look at the phones. Anyway, it's a whole thing. Like, that's the kind of vulture piece I want to read. It's like, why are they not using their iPhones? But yeah, no, I mean, it gets you talking. It's one for like arguing about with a pint after you've seen it, definitely.
Yeah, men will love talking about this film.
I'm not a man. How dare you?
I love talking about it.
I believe gender to be a social construct, but this is still deeply insulting.
But if a man says, oh, shall we go and see it on a date? Be careful.
Oh, absolutely not. Absolutely yeah. Not. No.
Exactly.
I will go and see it again. I will go and see it by myself. I will send my husband off on a separate trip just in case. Can't risk it. No. Oh, God. Film I absolutely loved, but yeah, do find quite do find it like a little bit difficult to talk about, but it is funny because it's like, it's so intense and sort of like humorless to me in like a good way, whilst I found Men so unintentionally funny. But we should get some scores on this. Regan, do you want to go first in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Yeah, I'd say I'd give it a 3, like, in anticipation. I'm not, like, the biggest Alex Garland fan, but I know he has a bit of a cult following, so I'm always kind of, I'm ready to be converted. I think during, I would probably give it a 4. Just, it's such an experiential film, and I know it just got my brain ticking at like 100 miles an hour. And I love that. I love that feeling when a film can do that to you. I was so invested in the performances. I'm not like the most audible film watcher. And I definitely, there were like quite a few gasps and, oh my God, this is from me, which is rare. So yeah, I was fully on board for it. But then yeah, in retrospect, I'd give it a pretty like firm 3. I wouldn't discourage anyone from going to see it, but it's the more I think about it myself, you know, the more holes I see, and not even because I'm looking for them, they just jump out. But again, I think you'll get a lot out of it.
Hannah, what about you? Civil War? Did you feel civil towards it?
Am I civil for Civil War? I'm the same as Rogan. It's a solid like 3, 4, 3 for me, with potential to go up to a 4, I think, if I rewatch it. I don't think it would go down to a 2. I think it's pretty solid scores on that. And enjoyment feels like a really weird one to assign to this film, but it's certainly interesting, and I am glad it exists, and I do think it is an interesting kind of entry to that like canon of like films about like films imagining kind of a future war in America. Weirdly, it made me think of Starship Troopers, like and Southland Tales. Those are the two places my mind went, which I don't think.
Ooh, high highs and low lows.
I love Southland Tales, so I'm not going to comment, but I'm interested to hear other people's opinions on it for sure when more people have seen it.
Yeah, I think I probably had a 3 in anticipation. I mean, like, enjoyment doesn't feel like the right word, but like in terms of like intensity of experience, I genuinely think I'm at a 5. I can't think of anything that like kind of hit me in the heart in quite the same way. Probably a 4 in retrospect. I actually think it's a film that does like improve upon digestion, upon like conversations with friends, upon talking with you wonderful people about it. And I know, I'm really sad that Alex Garland is giving up filmmaking. I mean, I had a wonderful conversation with him, and like I really, really enjoyed our chat. I did get the feeling that this is not part of the process that he loves, and maybe kind of, you know, maybe once the press tour is over, he hopefully may reconsider.
If he can make films but not have to speak to anyone about them or hear what anyone thinks about them.
Oh, I mean, the dream for anyone.
I've made some art. You can't criticize it. Me with my mum.
Well, speaking of people making some art.
Is that what we're calling it?
Good Lord. Next up, it's Back to Black.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Back to Black delves into the life and career of Amy Winehouse, beginning her early days in the early 2000s as a North London jazz musician and culminating in her rise to fame as a Grammy Award-winning singer. Hannah, again, personal to me. I used to know Amy. She was a wonderful soul. I'm not going to be balanced on this one. Can you kick us off with the abomination that is Back to Black?
I was thinking about this earlier and I was just like, how do I begin? Like, maybe just with like a long sigh.
A lawsuit. I think we should file a lawsuit.
I will say, like, from the beginning, I think that this film didn't need to happen. I don't think it should have happened. I think when it was announced, I was very much like, I don't see why we're doing this. And I don't think we need to do this. Amy is someone that I loved when I was growing up. I remember when Rehab came out like when I was in like year seven, and I loved it. And all my friends would like laugh at me because they were like, oh, it's not very cool. And now, like, you know, like 5 years later, not even 5 years later, like, you know, 2 years later, it's like, oh, she's like the biggest kind of star in British music. And I was like, yeah, she's really good. Anyway, so she's someone that I have a lot of like kind of affection for.
You doing a full hipster, I was into it before everybody else.
Northern town, yes. Not in, obviously in London, no, very, very much not the case. But among kind of my set, yeah. Like, you know, it was definitely something that was a little bit new to us. We were kind of, you know, kids who were like very much like, you know, the dregs of the Spice Girls days. Like, and this was not Spice, as they make a big thing in the film. Like, it's not, I'm not a Spice Girl, as she says in the film, like repeatedly. But yeah, it's just like, take your worst, your lowest standard for a biopic, which for me is probably like Bohemian Rhapsody. And it's worse than Bohemian Rhapsody. And I for a long time didn't think that could happen. But I think the thing is with Bohemian Rhapsody, it was like, this is really bad. And it's like horribly acted and just unnecessary and like awful. But it didn't feel like there was any kind of malice behind that film. I felt it was like a cash grab and it was like a bit icky. But it was like, no, they clearly like, you know, they love Freddie Mercury. And watching Back to Black, I just felt like there's no love here. This is like the most cynical use of her name and her music, and like abuse, I guess, continued abuse is what it felt. You know, like she was abused so much during her life by so many people, and it feels like that has just continued, and it just made me angry. I don't often feel angry watching movies, even if they're bad. I usually just kind of feel indifference, but I was just I just found it so misjudged and like cheap looking. The whole thing, like, it just makes my blood boil thinking about how uninspired it is and how lazy it is and how it basically paints this woman as this, you know, friendless, lonely creature who her only, like, the only thing she had to live for was this absolute asshole of a husband, and then she couldn't have a baby, so she killed herself. That is basically how they paint it in the film, and it made me like so angry watching it. So I can only imagine how it was for you, Layla, as someone that knew her, because I was like, I was doing that thing that moms do at the cinema. I was like shaking my head, I was tutting, I was like, I was, you know. I'm sure the listeners are like, oh, Hannah's really going off on one. But like, yeah, it's hard to talk about because I found it such a bankrupt film.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, I'm writing the review for Little White Lies and I'll be filing it very shortly. But I found it really difficult. I hit a very high word count, higher than you want from me, because I've been struggling to encapsulate all the ways it's so deeply harmful. And I think the thing that I've been thinking about a lot, so I've seen the film twice.
Oh God.
And I speaking to David, and he said, "Oh, are you sure, you know, you want to see it for a second time?" And I was like, "Yeah, I don't want to miss anything."
I'm going in with a notebook.
Yeah, but I think the thing that really kind of upset me is, again, I wasn't friends with her, but I remember when my dad bought me the Back to Black album when I must have been like 10 or 11, you know. I remember when she died then a few years later, and I was in the car with my dad and we heard it on the radio. And then a couple of days after that, I made the pilgrimage from deep south up to like deep north London to lay flowers, you know, and I'm now the age she was when she died. And there is like no sense of her youth, I don't think, is you get hit with an end card that says, you know, she died of alcohol poisoning after a long period of sobriety. She was age 27. But the whole film paints her as this kind of like autonomous architect of her own destruction. There is no sense that this is a young woman in a music industry that we know, like we have had all the conversations about Britney Spears over the past few years and like countless other, you know, young female stars. And I know Amy, you know, would not want to be lumped with Britney Spears or any other female star, but that is the truth of the way the industry, you know, treats young women. There is zero sense of that. There is, it's like every choice in the film is designed so that everyone else's hands are clean, and it's really disgusting. It's like they make a point of, you know, it's been kind of like, I don't know, I'm not here to contradict anything, but it's been the kind of narrative that Blake, her ex-husband, was not the person to introduce her to hard drugs. He did hard drugs separately and she did it of her own accord. And then, of course, they make a point in the film of showing the first time she tries hard drugs is when she's apart from him. You know, her dad is conveniently absent for large chunks of when things get bad and then comes in at the end to rescue her. You know, she stands up to the record label, right? So therefore, there's no question that they could be pushing her beyond her wills when she's clearly unwell. Because she's Amy, she ain't no Spice Girl, no one can tell her what to do. And it's so genuinely upsetting, the idea that a young woman can be vulnerable and also ambitious, that a young woman can be like in love and creative and smart, but also still 19, 20, 21, 22. Like that these two ideas can't coexist in these filmmakers' worlds. That like she was autonomous, therefore everyone else's hands are clean. And it's just a real shame. And it's the paparazzi who made it worse. And it's another strange thing as well, because, I mean, I'm not disagreeing at all that, of course, the tabloids, paparazzi treated her like absolutely disgustingly. Again, something that we've been reckoning with culturally over the past, you know, few years, looking at other stars. And I mean, even with the documentary in 2015, you know, it's not like a revelation how she was treated. But there's also no real sense of her stardom. There's no real sense of her artistry. You know, there's never a scene where she has a team busy around her, like hair and makeup, costume, mic check. There's no kind of sense of her as a public person. It's all very intimate and very sad. And then there are paparazzi there. It's like just so, it's so bizarre and so sloppy. Mm. And sorry, I can just keep going. But there are just so many bizarre choices where they rewrite these very like easily searchable moments.
Mm. Well, this is the thing, because it's in our lifetime. It's very recent. Like the three of us remember Beats from this film. And I remember seeing her win the Grammy.
I was at the Hawley Arms.
I was at the Hawley Arms. Okay, Grandma. No, I told you, Layla, I have a friend who was also friends with Amy, and I can't even imagine how this must feel to people, you know, like you that knew her. Because when you, the other thing is like, when you watch it and you see them recreating these moments, and you know, kind of no disrespect to Marissa Bella, who like, I think is kind of doing what she can with like a pretty like insurmountable task to play someone who all of us have seen footage of and all of us remember the way she talked and the way she sang and her stage presence. And all of us have seen footage of her. It's incredibly difficult to do that with any star, to kind of channel that energy. And she's a decent singer. I think like the recreations of the music work okay, apart from one instance where they play the actual audio for Back to Black over this kind of montage thing. And then you're like, oh, yeah, no, that's Amy singing. And that's like suddenly making me realize how kind of like not bad, but like kind of subpar, like, you know, it just can't compare. And all these kind of beats that it's recreating, like the paparazzi photos, like the moment at the Grammys, it just all feels like a kind of pantomime. It just felt like in such poor taste. And I think it would be genuinely like devastating to her to think this is how her family wanted to remember her. I how dare you? Sorry, it's making me angry again. And also, you know, Rogan just mentioned the documentary. We've seen footage. Like, you know, we've seen how some of this played out. And I know that Blake has said, oh, well, you know, it was manipulated and stuff. And I'm like, are you for real, man? Like, you can't, there are some things you can't manipulate to that extent. And like, it feels like I'm being culturally like gaslit by a film.
It 100% team Asifkapedia.
It's a total wash of her legacy. And I mean, even with the like recreating of these clips, I mean, there's a scene, Amy's first appearance on Jonathan Ross, where they literally superimpose the actress into the original Jonathan Ross footage, which is just like, it looks bad and it's just a stupid choice. And then they recreate the Grammys moment, but they like cut out lines from her speech, where the most iconic line from that Grammys acceptance speech is, and to my Blakey incarcerated, or something like that. She mentions that Blake is in prison. And they don't include that in the film. They show the whole Glastonbury performance of Me and Mr. Jones, where she's singing It'll Be Me and Blake Again, and then she hits a fan, she lashes out at a fan, and they do that full performance and don't include the hit. And I'm not saying these are the most glowing moments, obviously, in Amy's legacy, and they should be shown, but the intentional choice to choose those moments and then edit them, it's like, it would feel so much more sinister if it was done well, but it's done so badly that it's just stupid.
I mean, I don't want to cut Mike myself. I mean, I weren't close. I know her, but someone I was very fond of, and I was very upset when she passed. But like, I just don't think it also gets how clever and funny she was. Like, it kind of drains her of all of her wit. And like, you just reminded me, Rogan, of like one of the funniest things Amy ever did was they had a concert for Nelson Mandela, and like everybody was singing Free Nelson Mandela, and she was singing Free Blake My Fella.
That's the kind of person she was. Like,
yeah. Oh,
she gosh, was. I remember watching her on Number One Buzzcocks, and like, you know, that show, a lot of things like problematic about that show during the Lamar and Amstel days. But that's kind of when I like fell in love with her, you know, as a teenager watching her, because she was like, so, and even though, you know, she was clearly going through it, she was so funny and so quick and like just no bullshit. Like, you know, she would just cut people, like cutting like. The thing was, like, Simon Amstel was like, you know, the kind of mean host who got one over on everyone. But she would cut him down in like a second. It was like this, he was like a little schoolboy. And, you know, that's the kind of life and like, you know, just joie de vivre that you don't get watching the film. You just like, it's just 2 hours of like misery. And like Blonde, I just think that is such an insult to these women who had to deal with so much shit and are still now like beyond the grave, having to put up with it, and other people writing their legacy. And it just, yeah, I think it's quite an evil film.
Yeah, and I think, Sam Taylor Johnson has gone on record saying that she did speak to the family, but they had no input and she couldn't get in touch with Blake. But, you know, she wanted to speak to everyone out of respect, but they had no real sway over the film. And it's like,
weird how Asifkapedia managed it.
Yeah, yeah, but it's also like, if you think that gives this project any credence, have I got news for you? Because it just makes you seem, honestly, so much worse. It's like, if she was openly a mouthpiece for people in her life who exploited her, at least I'd understand why this film is the way it is. But the fact that she can produce, and the team behind it can produce this film, and then act like it's actually more honest, you know, because allegedly there's no familial involvement. It's like, pull the other one. What do you think that makes me think it's good? Like, it's, I have eyes. Like, it's awful. It's so bad. And like, just, it's really like genuinely quite upsetting. And I mean, for Marissa Abella, like, you're right, she does have an insurmountable task. And I think she's a really wonderful actress. Like, I'm a big fan of the TV show Industry, which I feel like is bigger in America because it's HBO, but it's like BBC over here. And it's really great. And I recommend it. I love her in that. I love that show. And I'm like, you know, she does the best she can. I found like her speaking voice a lot more distracting than I found her singing voice, honestly.
Oh yeah, it felt like working class cosplay to me. I thought I think it was generally like quite that element was also quite offensive.
Yeah, for sure.
It reminded me of you know, I don't know if you remember, this is a really niche reference, but Emily Browning's accent in Legend when she's playing like the wife of one of the Kray twins, and she's doing the voiceover and she says like cup of tea, and I was just like it's just grating, especially when you're around like London accents all the time. You can really tell when someone is like doing it not well. And Amy did have a very distinctive way of talking and a really incredible turn of phrase. And like, again, yeah, just kind of none of that life comes across. She seems like it kind of ill at ease, the actress, like in the role. And I'm not really surprised, but also like everyone else is bad. Eddie Marsan's bad.
Eddie Marsan's bloody awful.
Manville. I'd never seen her turn in a bad performance until now. And I was like, God, even she knows what's going on here. Like, it. Awful. Jack O'Connell, awful. Just awful.
I wonder, honestly, but like some of, I mean, I don't think Eddie Marsan is that talented, but like the rest of them, like, you do honestly wonder whether like they were purposefully sabotaging it. They were so terrible.
They came in as ringers. They were like, we've got to take this down from the inside. You have to wonder, because my God, it was like, I can't even think of it, you know, a kind of standard for how like bad I found the acting. Like, I think she's fine, but like not good.
I did see a very funny meme online that was like, I love all of my Ken Loach players equally, but I'm not terribly fond of Eddie Marsan. Like, it's like,
I'm
awful.
Not really a fan of
his. I saw an interview with him where he recently said that, like, he's playing a good father who with a daughter who is unlucky enough to have an addiction issue. And I was just like, if that's what you think fucking happened, like, good Lord.
It's really abhorrent, but like, I don't know. I really hope Marissa Abella works again, because I do think, as many issues as I do have with her performance and the accent being a big one, she's not the worst part of this film. And I mean, there are like, of course, the trailers and clips and going around and going viral and people making memes and being like, oh God, this looks terrible. You wouldn't believe if you saw the real thing that she is not the worst part.
Yeah.
Like, it's...
Yeah, it doesn't fail because of her.
It doesn't fail because of her. Like, and I don't know why I feel so protective of her. I just really like that show and want more people to watch it. But it's really shocking and really upsetting.
Very much like Civil War. It's a shocking experience, but not for those who... Just, you're kind of just like, how did this get made?
Not because it's an experiential marvel, because it's like an affront to morality and good taste.
It is like, you know, with these biopics, like, so I don't entirely buy that, like, biopics are dead in the water and we've got to look for something else. I think like Priscilla was a really good example of like the fact we can, and Oppenheimer as well, you can do interesting things with that as a starting point. But this is like really bottom of the barrel level filmmaking, like even on a competency level. Like, the editing is bad, like there's like cuts that I can't really use that through this twice, Rogan. You're so much stronger than I am, because I am barely sitting through it once.
I'm trying to just, gosh. And I think it's just so fucking egregious. Like, the, you know, the Blake and Amy meeting scene. I mean, it could have been called like Amy and Blake, right? It has the same.
It wants to be Sid and Nancy, but it won't, like, it pulls its punches because it's
Pam and Tommy.
I liked Pam and Tommy, kind of. It's not Pam and Tommy. It's so much worse than that.
You know what I mean? It's like, it's that kind of, just sort of, it's just so fucking gross. It's really gross.
I cannot think of a genuinely, like, and I think this is quite rare, I cannot think of a single reason to recommend this. I think it is artistically and morally
bankrupt. It's bad.
And it's boring.
It's boring. It's bad. You would do better spending 2 hours of your life just watching like clips
of her on YouTube, which is what I did after the film. I went home and I watched some clips of her and I was like, yeah, like she was incredible. And like, even at her very worst, she was still a much more interesting presence to watch than anything in this film. You won't learn anything about her from this, apart from that she was dealt such an incredibly shitty hand. But, you know, if you've been paying attention, you know, kind of, you know that. And it's, yeah, just makes me angry that this is, and like Rogan said it best earlier, like the fact that when making films about women who are incredibly talented but do struggle with some kind of element of their life and do have these like vulnerabilities, we can't seem to make films about them that aren't incredibly insulting. And I don't know what it is, but like, yeah, I just, what a waste of everyone's time.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel apt that I am now deeply depressed and we're about to go into melancholia.
Yeah.
But beforehand, would you like to do some scores? I'll go first. 1-1-1. Hannah, what about you?
I probably a 2-1-1, maybe. I don't know. Even the two, I'm kind of like, am I just being like, do I just not want to give it a 1-1-1? I mean, just blah, you know, just no kind of noise I can make can signify how worthless I think this is as a film. And I've seen some pretty worthless films in my time. I lately have been on that beat, it feels like, for Little White Lies. But yeah, just the kind of, it's not even that it's incompetently made. It just the air of kind of money grabbing behind it and, you know, the kind of cynicism of it all just made me feel very ill.
Yeah, I'd say 2-1-1, an honest 2 for me, because I was dreading it. But again, like Marissa Abella. And yeah, Amy can speak for herself still. As long as we have access to her music, Amy can speak for herself. And you can go and listen to the album, because you are not going to glean anything from this one.
As a planet hurtles towards a collision course with Earth, two sisters cope with the approaching doomsday in different ways. So, Hannah Strong, the lady that wrote the book on Sofia Coppola, which basically makes you a fully fledged member of the Kiki Hive.
My lady, my love. Yeah. No, I've loved Kirsten Dunst since I was like, I don't know, 10. First time I saw Bring It On, I was like, this woman is my world, my everything. I would march to the end of the earth for her. If she has one fan, it's me. You know, I love her so much. And like watching her on the Civil War press tour has been such like a balm for the soul, because she's like so blunt. And she's been doing this since she was like a small child, and she still just kind of says what she wants to say. And she's so funny. And I mean, not in this film. This film, she's devastating. But yeah, I remember that when I saw Melancholia for the first time, I was a student, and you know, students are, a lot of us have a rough time anyway. But I was particularly, I had a really horrible like first year of university, and it was this film, and We Need to Talk About Kevin, and I was just like, oh, movies, hey, like you know, it was kind of that moment of understanding, like, oh, maybe these things are a way to kind of understand how I feel inside. Which I'd kind of had in the past a little bit with Virgin Suicides, but I think it's really interesting that she made that film when she was basically 18 and then made this film, you know, like 10, slightly over 10 years later, kind of touching on a similar theme, more like finite, I guess, in Melancholia. But yeah, I was saying to Rogan, I rewatched it last night, and the feeling this film gives me, like, it's like it gives me this feeling of like pressure in my chest, which I don't really get. It's not kind of like stress. It's just like, it just feels so heavy, especially the first half of the film. I think it's, you know, Lars von Trier has been very honest about how like depression has influenced him as a filmmaker, and how this film in particular was very influenced by a depressive episode he experienced. And it's so incredible the way he articulates that through this just kind of like noise that is created during this wedding between Kirsten Dunst's character and Alexander Skarsgård's character. It's meant to be, you know, the happiest day of her life, but you notice all these kind of microaggressions and tensions, and the character of Justine's like performance starting to crack. And it's just devastating. It's so sad and so upsetting to kind of watch that. unravel. And like the handheld camera work, I think, is like a stroke of genius, because you have this incredibly beautiful setting in this Swedish castle and this like really beautiful film grain and, you know, kind of color grading for the film. And then you have like this like incredibly intrusive, very shaky handheld camera, which totally for me kind of emulates the feeling of like being in a depressive episode and being just kind of so overwhelmed by the world around you and so completely unable to do anything. And then in the second half, we switch completely to Claire, who is Justine's sister, played by Charlotte Gainsbourg. And it's a much more austere, like, framing, and I think incredibly simple way to differentiate between the two, but it just works so wonderfully. And I love a film about the apocalypse. Like, it's my jam. And I love that Lars von Trier said of the film, like, oh, I read somewhere that people that are depressive are much better in a crisis because they already think that a bad thing is going to happen. And like, that feels very real to me. And Rogan and I were talking, we were like, I get where Justine's coming from. She finds out the world's going to end and she's like, okay, yeah, fair enough.
Yeah, no, you want to figure out a catastrophe, talk to someone who's been catastrophizing for their entire lives. That makes sense.
Exactly. But yeah, I mean, yeah, I just think it's such an incredible film. And I wish I'd seen it in the cinema when it came out. And I should next time it's, because I know they re-released quite a few of his films last year through Curzon's, like, big celebration. And I didn't go and see it. And I'm kicking myself now because I think it would be really incredible on the big screen. But yeah, I think it's a masterpiece. And also, weirdly, you reminded me when we were talking about Civil War, because the way that like the two war photographers kind of handle this like situation, Kirsten Dunst plays a very kind of similar character in a way, in that she's very resigned. And then actually towards the end of the film, she kind of like loses it a little bit and starts being more the kind of Claire character and panicking. But I think it's one of the finest films out there about depression, about kind of how that feels without it being totally kind of didactic and, you know, without her, you know, being shrieking or anything.
I mean, yeah, Rick, I mean, we're living in a very depressing time. It doesn't feel like too far removed, like this idea that it's all going to be smashed into smithereens. Like, do you think like melancholia captured something quite profound?
Funnily enough, Layla, I went back on antidepressants 3 days ago. But no,
that won't save you.
Yeah. No, not from the
big... Save Kiefer Sutherland.
Is it? Yeah. I mean, I saw this film recently and it was... I didn't realise at the time, but it was my first Lars von Trier film, and first and only so far. I think there's so much discussion, obviously, around how divisive his films are. I've always kind of thought, okay, I need to be... Let me just be in the right head frame for it. And then, you know, past few weeks I have been. And I agree with everything Hannah said. I thought it was so beautiful and so sad and very funny in parts. I mean, there's like Stellan Skarsgård is just being this oppressive ad man, her boss, you know, and then he has his like slimy little nephew and like Udo Kier, who's the wedding planner, who is just just fuming at her for destroying this beautiful wedding.
I cannot talk to her. She destroyed my wedding. He's so good.
With like, you know, getting her depression all over the place over his beautiful plans. And you know, in Kiefer Sutherland, who I think is really, I mean, can't say I'm super familiar with the guy's work, I'll be honest, but really.
Not even 24? Nothing?
No, not 24.
So I've never seen 24. He's really good in the Kane Court Martial Mutiny.
Okay.
You're a fan of the work of his father, Donald Sutherland?
Yes.
Okay. So it's not the whole Sutherlands.
No, it's just Kiefer. But I mean, I thought he was wonderful. And I mean, you know, and he's this straight American guy who just kills himself when it gets too real. And I'm like, do you know what? I'm right there with you, babe. But sorry, no. But, and I mean, we haven't even really spoken about Alexander Skarsgård, who, I mean, Hannah and I both high-pitched voices, sister wives,
kicking
for
my
Alex.
Feet, twirling my hair.
very like Cher Horowitz vibes when I talk about him. But like, he's oh my God, he's just heartbreaking in this. It's so devastating. And that feeling of like, yeah, this, there is someone here who like loves you and is trying their best to move heaven and earth for you. And like really trying to show you and trying to be there with you. And it just doesn't register because the depression's just taken over. And like him playing the character of just the dejected husband who's really, you know, yeah, just devoted, and it's really, really emotional. And I think he really got, like, he really got me. And I didn't realize, I just didn't realize how much. And I think he's really, I think he's like massive. So everyone, you know, he's like the big scary man, right? But I think he really excels in this role as just, he's so tender. And I think, you know, Lars saw it.
He saw the vision.
Lars von Trier gets it. He's for the girls, no. But like, I think, I don't know. I just think I'd like to see him in more of that because it's a real strength of his. And I say this like half jokingly, but it's a very good film about astrology, honestly.
it's the Scorpio causing all the problems.
But I mean, I'm a real astrology, tarot, sage, all that jazz. Love it. And yeah, I don't know. It really feels like certain transits happening, but that's going to be for a very small portion of Little White Lies listeners. Anyway, I think it's a wonderful film, and I think I'll be looking at the Prince Charles, you know, for when they next screen it.
I had this thing years ago where I was like, there should be a mockumentary about the Skarsgårds, like all of them, and it should be directed by Lars von Trier. And I think this is the closest we're going to get. And I'm like, Lars, like, just one meeting with me and I'll sell you on my mockumentary, because I think he would do it and I think it'd be really funny. And I want Alex and Stellan to actually play like father and son, because in this they're like, he's his best man and like mates or something. But I don't know, there's like a weird kind of undercurrent. It's like he doesn't really like this guy very much. I don't know. It's all very, there's so many tensions. And if I didn't find it such a stressful film to watch, I would like to watch it and kind of dig into that more. Because we haven't even talked about the mother and father, who are Charlotte Rampling and John Hurt. And they are just like,
oh my God, John Hurt. Oh.
He's very sweet, actually. I mean, it seems to have dementia, but like he's very sweet. But Charlotte Rampling, I love it when she just plays a total cunt. And she is like, cunt master in this film. She doesn't give a shit about anyone. She is there to cause problems. And I love it when there's a bit where Keith Sutherland kicks
her. That's who I'd be in the apocalypse.
Keith Sutherland tries to kick her out of the house. I'm laughing because it's so funny in the film. Like, he tries to kick her out of the house by throwing all her suit, like her possessions, out onto like the front drive. And then the butler, just this kind of little old like Swedish man who they call Little Father, like kind of wheels out like a minute later, picks it all up and takes it back inside. And it's just like ludicrous. It's such a ludicrous film, but in the kind of best way. And I really think, like, if you're not a fan of Lars, I think it is maybe the most accessible of his films, which probably isn't saying much for Lars von Trier, But yeah, I'm so glad it exists.
In a weird way, it feels like almost like the least confessional of his films. Like, this feels like Lars least on his should have gone to therapy rather than made this film sort of
be. But then he said it's incredibly confessional. Like, he said, like, the character of Justine is, like, based on him, basically.
It is, but I understand. But it just feels more universal and less sort of, like, self-indulgent, I suppose. Like, I feel like he's trapping into something bigger than himself.
Yeah, the end of the world.
Which is interesting, because I think, honestly, when you are having like moments of depression, it does feel like everything is a metaphor for what you're going through.
Yeah. And sometimes you do sit there thinking, maybe the world could just end, which is objectively a ridiculous thing to sit there thinking, like, oh, I'm so sad. If the world could just end, that would be great, because I'm really sad. But she's living the dream. She's like, oh, exit route, great. Just need to sit here. Like, I know, there is something comforting about it. Like, you're like, you know, could be worse, could be better.
Could be worse. Your family members could make Back to Black.
Oh my God.
Need to have like a group pact that if any of us die, the others stop that happening. Don't, yeah, Back to absolutely. Black me, please.
I don't believe that can happen to me twice in terms of people I know.
Layla, if it could happen to anyone, it could happen to you.
Twice.
Yeah.
Twice.
What an unhinged episode this has been.
But yeah, before we wrap up, you guys are going to do one last thing. You're going to give us a non-movie recommendation.
Yeah, I actually left my house this week, so I can give one in all sincerity.
Oh, Hannah, I'm so excited.
You know what
it's gonna be. In theory, that you're going to do a non-movie recommendation based on a recommendation I gave you, because I was right, this thing slaps. Okay,
yeah.
Go.
Yeah, so my recommendation is a play by Jez Butterworth, which is currently on in London, which is called The Hills of California, which I can't now say without wanting to sing it, because it is a song, and they use the song in the play. And anyway, it's a really good song if you ever listen to it. It's an old, like, 50s standard. It's very catchy. Anyway, it's currently on in London. I don't know for how much longer, but definitely if you can go and see it. I got a £50 front row ticket and it was incredible. Just so funny, so deadpan. So if you've seen any of his work, like The Ferryman or Jerusalem, you kind of know the kind of vibe going in. This is maybe, I think, a little bit lighter, but not much. Like, maybe not lighter. I don't know. I can't really get a read on where I would rank it in terms of the Jez Butterworth depression scale, but it's really quick, and you do kind of, the audience were like in stitches, and then in the second half there's kind of like a bit of a shift, and it gets progressively more upsetting. But yeah, I just thought it was really remarkable. It's set in Blackpool during the 70s, early 70s, and there's just some really great like British cultural references in there. I don't know how this is going to travel. I assume it will go to the States, but I don't know how it will travel, because there's some niche like Brit jokes in there for you. And there's a line I found very funny where they're talking about David Bowie and they're like, oh, this new David Bowie going, ooh, look at me. I mean, I'm on the stage in my sequins. And it's just like, it's such a specific way that kind of Northern British people have about them that I think the play really captures beautifully. And I thought the performances were incredible. There's kind of four young girls who are in it and playing the kind of younger version of the principal cast. And they're like fantastic. They're doing like song and dance routines, and that normally would not work for me. I would be like, giving like stage kids, you know, it would be a bit jarring, but I thought they were fantastic. And it's really good. I will say, if you sit in the front row, the stage cigarette smoke, which is like pervasive throughout the play, gets quite overwhelming. But if you can go, like, run. It's really brilliant. And yes, Layla recommended it, is why I went. I trust Layla's opinion. And yeah, I had a really great time.
It's so good. I don't think it's gotten anywhere near the reception that it truly deserves. I think if you're coming off the back of Jerusalem, which is kind of generally considered to be like the greatest play of the past like few decades, it's a hard thing to follow up. So I think it's a little bit like been underserved. Because honestly, every act is better than the act that preceded it. And every act is great.
And the set is incredible. They have like a revolving set, which is like really like intricately decorated, and you can kind of just like look and pick out these details. Anyway, I could do a podcast where I'm just raving about how great I think it is, but truly, like,
we should do that, and then maybe we'll get free theater tickets. Like, this is like not a bad idea.
But yeah, I that's a very, very strong recommendation from me.
Regan, what about you?
I forgot about this bit, so I've been, as Hannah's been talking, I've been racking my brains. What have I been doing? And honestly, the kind of highlight of my recent weeks has been discovering Roti King, which is a restaurant.
Ooh, it's so good.
It's so good. And they've opened, this is for all the bag men listening, they've opened one on Lower Marsh in Waterloo. So I highly just go to Roti King. It's really good. It's like reasonably priced. You will always have a good meal. I'm so happy now I don't have to go to North London. I think everyone should just get on Roti King, man. If you're not, I feel like I'm definitely like last to the party.
Oh, no, I've still not been.
Yeah, I'm really bad.
Oh, Hannah.
Yeah, I know.
Oh my God.
I know.
It's so good. But, you know, they also have some Rati Kings in, like, you know, the market halls.
Oh.
They have, like, a little bit, like, you know, the sense that you can get kind of, like, a little curry and a roti. And, okay, this is becoming an advert for Rati King, but, like... Oh, it's so good. I took my dad the other day, and we're not close. But I was just like, I think we'd both really enjoy this as a lunch. And we had a wonderful time.
It's so great. I mean, I have been to a couple of exhibitions and theatre shows in the past few weeks and unfortunately cannot recommend any of them. So going with food, Rati King, get yourself to Lower Marsh if you're in South, or if you're by BFI.
I encourage like restaurant recommendations on this show as like a cultural thing, because it's increasingly like London has such a great food. Well, I mean, other places have great food as well, I'm sure, and I would love to hear from other people about other cities' food scenes. But yeah, there's so much great food out there, and I need people to help me, because like all my favorite places have been overtaken by TikTokers, and I need new places.
Oh my God, we're gonna go for a Rati. I'm so excited. Thank you very much. If you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were Hannah Strong and Rogan Graham. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Sankus.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend. Winning is an everyday mindset, and we're here to help. I'm Craig Robinson. Join me and Coach John Calipari for Ways to Win. We're kicking off during March Madness. Cal's Kentucky Wildcats are in the hunt. So throughout the tournament, I'm going to call up my friend to ask about his wins, losses, and especially what he's telling his players in the locker room.
You got to win every day.
Find the Ways to Win podcast anywhere you listen.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.